Our first case for argument this morning is Rexam Beverage Can Company against Bolger. Mr. McLaughlin.
Your Honor, may it please the Court. I am Jim McLaughlin, and I represent Rexam Beverage Can Company. This morning, I would like to focus on three particularly important issues on this appeal, not slighting any of the others, but focusing on these three. The first is the question of whether the counterclaimant in this case, the landlord, Bolger, qualifies for a recovery under the Illinois penalty statute. And the district court erred because it focused on an incorrect definition of willfulness under the Illinois statute, and it ignored the behavior of the landlord and the legal importance of the landlord. What the statute requires is that the landlord demand possession in writing, and as the Murphy case holds, once the landlord makes that election, it cannot change. In this case, the undisputed evidence was that the landlord did not, in fact, after an initial demand possession. In fact, the landlord did exactly the opposite. And so the issue then is, under the statute, a penalty statute to which a rule of lenity applies and to which the Illinois courts have repeatedly said the landlord must maintain strict compliance, as the Illinois Court of Appeals said in the Stride decision, did the landlord qualify under the statute by refusing to accept possession? And, for example, to give
Wait a minute.
Yes, Your Honor.
You would tender checks to the landlord, and the landlord would send them back.
Well, Your Honor, the landlord accepted rent. The landlord sent base rent checks back, but under Article 3C of the lease, rent also included utilities, insurance, security. And the landlord not only accepted those checks, but in writing, repeatedly demanded them. So, for example, at Exhibit 34, the landlord said, and this is in September of 2007, there is no agreement terminating the lease as of September 19, 2007, and this is a matter now being brought to the court's attention for final determination. Thus, the master lease remains in full force and effect, and Rexam is fully responsible for all costs and expenses thereof, including but not limited to utilities, taxes, insurance, security services, and all losses arising from fire and other occurrences, etc. The lease termination date will be determined by the court, and that is when the lessors will become liable and not before. That is in September 2007. In March, when the tenant said we are going to tender, March 2007, possession, the landlord said, quote, Mr. Brown, and this is Exhibit 9, Rexam Exhibit 9, Mr. Brown, in no way is Rexam going to be permitted by the owner lessors to vacate this facility on 327. Rexam cannot surrender this space without a formal written termination of lease satisfying in form and substance to the owner lessors. Now, what happened here and the issue that the district court failed to appreciate is that the Illinois courts and Illinois law does not allow the landlord to game a penalty statute. So the landlord at one point is saying, well, I made a written demand at the outset, and so therefore I have qualified under the statute. However, continually after that, the landlord accepts and indeed demands rent in the form of the utilities and other expenses, which, as I said, are defined as rent under Article 3C, and demands repeatedly that the tenant comply with all obligations of the lease, not merely the duty to repair, but all of the obligations under the lease, and says, indeed, you cannot get out of the lease until you negotiate and execute a lease termination agreement, and you give me notice. Counsel for the, and indeed the landlord went to court and said, in a motion, the lease has not been terminated, and we want you, court, to define a termination date, and we want you to define that termination date far in the future. The landlord took the position at Exhibit 27 of Wrexham, that the lease would run through December 31, 2007. So the penalty statute, properly understood, is tied to the basic Illinois common law, which says if you are a tenant at sufferance, all you have is naked possession, you have no privity. Whether you stay as a tenant at sufferance or you become a holdover tenant subject to a holdover tenancy of years, a year at a time, or a month by month, both of which under the common law are controlled by the text of the lease, is solely at the election of the landlord. Now, once the landlord makes the election no longer to treat the tenant as a tenant at sufferance, but to be bound by the lease, the landlord is still arguably entitled to the lease rent because he has elected that benefit, and these other benefits, month to month or for a year. This is very clear common law under Illinois. The landlord can make that election, or the landlord can treat the tenant as a tenant at sufferance and then arguably claim under the penalty statute. What Illinois law does not allow a landlord to do is game it so that the tenant is in an untenable position of heads, landlord wins, tails, lessee loses.
I don't understand that.
Well, Your Honor,
tenant can always avoid any rent obligation by finally vacating.
He can avoid the rent obligation by finally vacating. However, then there is the question of what happens to the repair or maintenance obligation that the landlord is demanding that the tenant comply with. And the issue,
either the tenant has to get out, perform the repairs, and vacate, or the tenant has to pay damages. It's perfectly possible to vacate and pay damages for noncompliance with a repair obligation.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. And if
so, what's the bind?
The bind here is when the landlord makes that election.
No, the bind is created by the tenant, which by staying over makes it impossible to comply with both the requirement to vacate and the requirement to repair.
At which point the tenant is liable for damages, but the issue is not whether the tenant is liable for damages in rent and repair. The issue is whether the tenant is liable for a double penalty. And what the Illinois court said is, the law will not uphold or justify a landlord in thus inducing a tenant to remain in possession of premises after the expiration of the lease.
That's what I don't understand. You can avoid the obligation for double rent by vacating and paying damages for failure to repair.
Yes, you can, Your Honor. And the issue here is if the land, but that the issue is the land, the Illinois law says the landlord cannot say to the tenant, I want you to stay and perform the repair obligations and still collect the penalty. Because at that point, what the Illinois law says is the tenant can make the wrong decision in retrospect. The tenant could say, the landlord is demanding consistently that I remain in possession to do these things. Okay, I will try to satisfy the landlord and see if we can work this out. And by doing so, if the tenant, quote, makes the wrong decision, close quote, the landlord is in the position to put the tenant in jeopardy of a penalty.
And what they work this out, were they hoping to work it out where they would stay and continue to operate?
Mr. Clancy,
that seems to be what the district court thought might be going on.
Mr. Clancy testified that that was early on his hope, but later he abandoned that hope, and his hope was to get the repairs done to the satisfaction of the landlord. And what the Kenwood Hotel...
Were they moving out in the process?
Yes. What happened is the record shows that Wrexham was able to get its subtenant out, moved out all of its equipment, but because of the size of this very large can-making machinery and the equipment that subtenant had in there, they couldn't clean up the building and do some of the repairs until that equipment was gone. Remember, they only had about 40 days before the lease expired. So they moved everything out, and at that point, you know, it could have said, landlord, here's your building, but the landlord said, you may not move. And so while the building was empty, Wrexham did these improvements and repairs.
You're saying they basically had vacated, but
their equipment, people, everything was out. The only thing they were doing was cleaning up the building.
And so if they had walked away from it, there would only have been damages.
Correct. And what the Illinois law says is, once the tenant is in a position to do that, you, landlord, have made your election, and you can't induce him to stay by demanding that they stay, because the statute says you have to demand possession. And once the landlord stops demanding possession, they have no longer met the obligations of the statute. And in some sense, what the Kenwood decision of the Illinois court says is, you cannot mislead the tenant. In the Kenwood decision, in fact, the issue was the tenant maintained possession with goods that the tenant had delivered to the facility in order to do repairs. And what the Illinois court there said, which is relevant to Judge Easterbrook's comment, is the plaintiff, the landlord, upon removal of the defendant from the apartment, had the right to reenter upon the premises and proceed with the work of restoration if the defendant, i.e. the lessee, was delaying the commencement of that work too long, and to charge for the expense of the work. We find nothing in the record which justifies the conclusion that the landlord either objected to the delay as unreasonable in time or took steps to do the work or hasten its completion. Here we have a situation where, again, the landlord could have come in to Wrexham and said, you're taking too long, I'll do the work. Instead, Mr. Bolger testified at trial. There was no way he was going to do that. That was something that the tenant had to do, and the tenant had to remain in possession, which is fine. The landlord can say, I don't want to do that. You do that, and you pay damages in the form of rent. But this is a penalty statute. And if the landlord is going to claim the benefit, what the Illinois courts have said is you must consistently demand possession, and you must remain in strict compliance with the statute. That is the Stride decision. Once the landlord said, don't leave, indeed you cannot leave until you negotiate these other agreements, and the landlord accepted the benefits under the lease, this is not a policy issue. This is a common law election that binds the landlord. And the policy is you don't reward the landlord with a penalty for changing the character of the tenancy. It is a fundamental question of whether you're going to allow. And yes, the tenant who sees may see clearly and make the quote right decision can say, you know what, the heck with it. I'll take my chance on damages of repairs. I will, you know, the landlord's going to take over. He's going to do those repairs. We'll fight about what was appropriate and what was about how much. And then I'll avoid this risk of the damages, of the double rent. However, what the Illinois law says is, the landlord cannot put the tenant in that conundrum of trying to guess which is the best way to go, and then whichever way the tenant jumps, try to arbitrage that. And that's what the landlord did here, tried to arbitrage it.
But so the Wrexham kept sending rent payments, and they kept sending them back.
Yes, Your Honor.
The first one that comes back must be some sort of a signal that this isn't the way it's supposed to be.
Absolutely. There is no doubt, Your Honor, that the situation here is very, I would call it confusing, both for the tenant and as a policy matter is confusing, because at the same time, the landlord is accepting other checks and indeed demanding other checks.
For what?
For the utilities, insurance, security, taxes.
They were paying the landlord all that stuff?
The landlord was demanding that they make the payments, and they made the payments directly to the relevant authorities. And in the exhibits I referenced, the landlord makes those payments. And those, again, are defined as rent. So the landlord is demanding some rent and saying, no, I'm going to hold the checks on others. Now, so that is the stark issue here under the common law. The next issue, Your Honor, is the question of the interpretation of the lease and whether there is an obligation to replace the roof. I want to assume for the sake of argument this morning that the district court's interpretation of the relevant of a key clause in 5C was the correct one. What the district court said is the first clause of Article 5C, which is at the appendix at page 112, is the lessor shall have no obligation with respect to the maintenance and repair of the premises or any buildings and improvements thereon. Now, the district court interpreted that to mean no obligation with respect to repair, replacement, or otherwise. The problem with that decision by the district court is that it is directly contradicted by the Illinois authority. If Your Honors read the Sandelman decision of the Illinois Court of Appeals, in Sandelman, the lease at issue had exactly or virtually the same language, that the landlord would be responsible for no maintenance. It was also a 25-year lease with multiple renewals, and it said that the tenant is not responsible for ordinary wear and tear. And what the Sandelman court said in that case was, well, yes, the landlord is not responsible under this for ordinary for repairs. That's what it says. But that does not mean that the landlord has absolutely no responsibility for extraordinary structural replacements.
And what the roof? Is that an extraordinary, the roof?
What is yes. The Sandelman decision then expressly holds that the replacement of a roof is extraordinary and it must be expressly considered in the text.
But 5.5c says lessee will solely be responsible for extraordinary changes that may be required.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's the decision that the district court then focuses on that. And let's assume that the district court's interpretation of that is correct. Then the question is, what happens to the next clause? And what is the impact of the next clause? If the tenant under that has to make certain extraordinary and structural changes, then the next clause is reasonable use and ordinary wear and tear accepted. So under basic grammar, that clause modifies what has gone before, all of what has gone before. So that clause is a limiting and modifying clause on what goes before, including the structural and extraordinary changes clause. And so then we have the question of what is the impact of that. And the answer to that is, which the district court erred in not seeing, even under its interpretation, that the tenant will be responsible for structural and ordinary changes that might occur. It might be fire. It might be storm. It might be any number of things that cause the need for extraordinary repairs. However, there is a single exception to the tenant's obligation to make these extraordinary repairs, and that single exception is ordinary wear and tear. And so we have this situation with the district court could easily have reconciled all of this language, which is consistent with the Stride decision. It is also consistent with the Junction Mine decision that is cited in our briefs, and it is also consistent with this court's Ricker decision. Instead, what the district court did is the district court said, no, what the ordinary wear and tear is it means the tenant doesn't have to maintain this in a pristine manner. And ordinary wear and tear is a process. As this court said in the Ricker decision, it is a process by which over time, be it a car or a roof or a hammer, through ordinary use, simply deteriorates, depreciates, and becomes useless at the end of the wear and tear.
But a leak in a roof is something that a tenant should repair under this lease.
An ordinary leak, absolutely.
And if leaks are allowed to continue for years, then they contribute to the severe deterioration of the structure.
Absolutely. However, the landlord did not plead in this case that the need for the roof was the result of negligent maintenance. The landlord's expert testified, in fact, that the reason the roof he believed needed to be replaced was that it was at the end of its useful life. Had the landlord pleaded negligence and negligent maintenance, that would be a different case. But that is not the case that we have before us, because the landlord didn't plead it and didn't prove it. I'll reserve the last minute for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Anthony Dowell, counsel for the defendant appellees, David F. Bolger, in the city of Fayette, Iowa. I'd first like to correct a couple of statements and make sure there's absolutely no confusion. The landlord never accepted any form of checks. Mr. McGlough, counsel stated on a couple occasions that landlord had accepted checks, and I believe everything is clear. What he meant was that Rexham paid the utilities, they paid the insurance, they paid the taxes while they remained in possession. The reason they did that is because Rexham was claiming that they had the right to remain in possession. There was never a transfer of checks of any kind that occurred.
Did they in fact move out? Did all their stuff moved out other than staying there to repair?
The lease terminated on March 31 of 06. Rexham was out of the building a year later in April of 07. They stayed over the end of the lease, waited over a year, moved out, and then spent several months repairing. And the district court concluded that possession transferred on August 31st of 07, 17 months after the termination of the lease.
And none of the repairs had been started before April of 07?
None at all. No.
Had bids been received for the repairs or estimates of what the repairs needed to be prior to April of 07?
April of 07, no. There was no there were demand. What the confusion that counsel attempts to capitalize on is that during that holdover period, my client, Mr. Bolger, was demanding, you need to fix that building. The roof needs repaired. Walls are crumbling. Glass is broken. You need to do these things. That is my building. It will return to me eventually. We don't know when yet. And I want those things fixed. The issue then becomes when there is a holdover tenant who is maintaining that or is staying in that building under claim of right, can a landlord still demand that repairs be completed under the prior lease without forfeiting the right to treat them as a trespasser? Now, in all of our correspondence, you know, from attorneys and all of our pleadings with the court, everything, we said, you're a trespasser. There's an Illinois statute. We're going to get double rent, just so you know, told them, over and over again. And what we found here, and we briefed this twice with the district court before trial. We spent a week on it at trial. And of course we briefed it after trial. The district court always said, in Rexham's mind, they are willfully holding over that building, wrongfully and willfully, and are subject to the penalty the Illinois holdover statute. My client never said that the lease has not been terminated. What my client said was, we need to determine how long Rexham is in possession. We asked the court to set that possession date. We knew we believed we would get double rent. And so at that point in time, my client was asking the court, Rexham saying, no, we're out of here. It's your building now. After that date, my client had said and asked the court, please set that date. Let us know for sure so that we know who is responsible for utilities, who's responsible for making sure the heat's on, because that remained in dispute. That confusion, though, was created by Rexham holding over. However, under the Illinois holdover statute, under all of the case law, there is nothing, no case that has ever examined a landlord's statement or the landlord's state of mind after the holdover period. Absolutely nothing there. Today, counsel cited the case of Kenwood Hotel. Again, we briefed this multiple times, spent a week in trial on it. We had our main briefs in the appeal. Didn't see that until the reply brief. And there's a reason. Kenwood Hotel, a lease terminated on August 31st, 1906. The lessee and the tenant and the landlord were negotiating for a new lease right up until that termination date, August 31, 1906. The day after, the landlord said, nope, I want you out. You can't stay any longer. In that case, it makes sense. The tenant was staying because it thought it could... was going to negotiate a new lease. In this case, my client, Mr. Bolger, had sent a letter a couple months before the lease termination date saying, get out, and never wavered on that point. What counsel is making hay with is statements made. He read a letter that was 2 years after that was going on. Based on some statements that my client made about what needed to be done if Rexham claimed that they were going to stay in that building.
What was the date that they started moving out where obviously the business could not continue?
I believe March and April of 07. slightly over a year after the termination of the lease. Another important point is that all of the case law focuses on the mindset of the tenant and what the conscious decisions were. The district court found that Rexam made a conscious choice to stay in that building, hoping to either win the lawsuit. I mean, they filed the lawsuit to keep possession, or through litigation leverage a new lease out of my client. The district court found that those conscious choices were never dictated by any of my client's demands. In fact, counsel can point to nothing in Rexam's statements, in Rexam's many letters or correspondence, where any Rexam person said, if you demand this, we will do it. In fact, to the contrary, our key exhibit is the Bolger Exhibit 26, which is a letter from Rexam's counsel, general counsel and president, that says, we are leaving the building. This is 1 year after the termination of the lease. This is in April of 07. But we will be completing repairs that Rexam believes are required under the lease. My client made many demands about replacing the roof, not done, repairing a rail spur next to the building, not done. Rexam can show nothing that they ever did based on my client's demands. What the district court therefore said was, because Rexam had stayed in possession for their own purposes, because they thought the penalty would not be severe for doing that, the duration of that was the result of Rexam's choices, not Bolger's demands, and that Rexam completed repairs, and on the day they completed repairs, the next day they turned over possession. Because of that, the entire holdover period was willful, and my client is entitled to double rent during that period.
Mr. Dale, I want to ask you about this roof. Roofs have useful lives. I think the evidence here is 20 to 25 years for this type of roof. So it was known that that roof would deteriorate over time. Isn't that normal wear and tear?
It is normal wear and tear until the point that it needs replacement. There is certainly a break point. If Rexam had turned that building over and it was a little shabby and not up to perfect condition, no, we could not demand it be brought up to perfect condition. But when that ordinary wear and tear had led to the point that water soaked through and oil leached through the building to the point where it could no longer be repaired, and in fact it had to be completely replaced, we've broken over beyond ordinary wear and tear into an extraordinary structural change.
So is your theory that Rexam's failure to do routine maintenance, as they were required to do, contributed to the condition of the roof?
Even if not, a roof does have an ordinary life. And if that ordinary life was up during Rexam's tenancy, they're required to replace it. And in fact, they did replace portions of that roof on multiple occasions during the time they were in the building. Now, if that were not required under the lease, I mean, you know, obviously everyone's perspective changes once the litigation papers start flying. In the ordinary business arrangement, Rexam was replacing that roof. They had done it in the 70s. They had replaced portions of it in the 90s. We have that in the record, showing that the parties understood that was Rexam's obligations under the lease. And the reason, there's three reasons. The lease says my client, the landlord, has no obligation, any type of repairs, major or minor. That Rexam was solely responsible for any type of maintenance of such buildings and premises. And then the key phrase that all the cases focus on, including all structural and extraordinary changes that may be required.
But don't Illinois cases require some really specific language about roofs to require a tenant to replace a roof?
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, I believe it's the Coleman case that... I believe at that. I'm not 100% certain where repairs were no longer sufficient and replacement was required. And I believe it was a structural failure clause in the lease that was allowed to apply to a parking lot as a structural failure. And I think that's the heating and or the HVAC case as well. I could be incorrect on that. Could be misremembering, but I think it's Coleman.
Are you familiar with the Quincy Mall versus Carasota Showplace case of last year?
I'm not, Your Honor. Is that in our briefing?
No.
I did not believe so. But I believe that the language, if it is more strict based on recent case law, the language, including all structural and extraordinary changes that may be required, certainly would include a roof. It is certainly a structural feature of a building with no need to specifically list out what those structural features would be that would fall under the term.
Did the landlord have any procedure for inspecting from time to time?
No, Your Honor.
It seems then when the, we'll call it the notice, wasn't forthcoming for renewal, that's when they took an interest in the condition of the building, wasn't it?
That's absolutely correct.
And was that in anticipation of taking over the building?
Or yes. Yes, Your Honor. And I think that this court may consider the context. This lease was a leasing vehicle, a 30 to 40 year lease that was started in the 1960s as a way to address taxes. My client built the building for Rexam. Predecessor of Rexam, established a very low lease rate that just covered the financing for that new building. My client, as he testified, I've cited the testimony, would only receive a profit when the building was returned, in addition to tax advantages from that structured arrangement.
Was this financing through an industrial revenue bond or something?
Private
financing?
It's private financing, and it was structured under the tax code at that time to allow the investors tax advantages and Rexam's predecessor tax advantages. Those are no longer in the tax code. One of the reasons that the city of Fayette, Iowa, owns this building now is because it was basically donated to them for they're the only ones that can receive benefits from the way it's structured at this point. But the point is, it was a structured vehicle that my client would have no oversight, no building management, no financial responsibility, did not pay any of the utilities or anything that my client would have to do, any kind of obligation or liability, was turned over to the tenant for the very, you know, as a key portion of this lease. And
but
every
the rent,
term...
The rent effectively just pays off the loan wherever it came from.
That's correct.
And then that would be in a construction loan, I suppose.
Right.
And then your client was mostly a builder as opposed to a landlord.
My client's more of a bank.
Oh, yeah?
He arranged the financing for this transaction, and then...
He contracted out to have it built?
Absolutely. And this raises an important issue. When a company such as my client is going to take back over a building, they need to be able to demand that repairs are made. They need to be able to. One of the other issues on the roof is, have we shown a diminution, a decrease in value equivalent to the estimate of repairs? Certainly, our estimate is beyond reproach. We presented an expert and said, here's what it would cost to replace that roof, and it's absolutely needed. Then the issue, Rexam has questioned whether we suffered that loss in the sale of the building. Well, that's absolutely impossible to show. Without getting into the minds of the various purchasers of the building and why they paid a certain amount, deals are made, discounts are given, but under the law, we were not required to produce both an estimate of the amount and proof of the diminution in value. All we had to show was that my client did not receive a windfall. We have shown evidence that the building was valued less, every purchaser was concerned with the condition of the roof, and therefore my client did not receive as much for it. But
after your client got all this settlement and judgment, then it gave it away to the city?
Yes. That is correct. It's outside the record. My client's a benefactor of the city of Fayette, Iowa, and for the variety of reasons and for the college there.
It was definitely a gift and not a relinquishment because of the tax.
Right. That's correct. Tax. And the original investors had donated their portions to the city of Fayette as a donation.
Let me ask you about the doubling. You double on a gross amount instead
yes.
of a net amount, and I'm curious about that because the rent and utilities and so forth were, in fact, paid and credited back by the district judge. Aren't you doubling that amount in addition to the rent amount?
When those are included in the gross amount, yes, they were doubled. We have a gross amount.
How
only
is that compatible with the statute? The statute says double the value of the land. Taxes aren't part of the value of the land. In fact, they reduce the value of the land. The higher the taxes, the less the value of the land. So how does one treat, for the taxes to be doubled, for the utilities to be doubled, we would have to treat taxes and utilities as part of the value of the land, because that's what the state statute says. And I don't see how that's possible as a matter of economics. Now, maybe there are state cases saying that notwithstanding the fact that taxes subtract from the value of the land, they're part of it. But it's hard
There's absolutely no case law one way or the other on whether to use a net rate or a gross rate on that. We obviously have a case.
Do you have any argument that taxes are part of the value of the land? That's the statutory language.
I do not, Your Honor. I can see that it would be appropriate if awarded a gross lease rate to double the set-off for payments made by Rexham.
And it was only single. It was only set off once.
It was only set off once. But, I mean, we had to urge a gross lease rate in view of that set-off claim. So it was required that we make a claim for a gross lease rate when there was a claim for set-off. But it would not be inappropriate to double the set-off to match the fact that there was a gross lease rate, doubled. I would point out, however, that I believe that argument may have been waived when Rexham elected to seek the set-off and a net lease rate. Rexham tried to have it both ways in a low lease rate and a net return.
So this is litigation.
At that point, they didn't like each other very much. I'm curious about your attorney's fees as well. The judge awarded them as of something like October of 07,
yes.
Everything forward, but there were a lot of issues that weren't attorney's fees were not awardable for.
Yes, there were. The attorney's fees were not awarded for getting Rexham out of the building and obtaining the double rent. The court had a break-off date in October of 2007. Up to that date, we had shown Rexham was not entitled to stay in possession of the building. After that date, we were fighting about the repairs to the building, and we continued to argue about when the termination of their possession ended. The court picked that date just as a convenient point to break off the attorney's fees. And under the case law, if claims are related, and everything in this case related to the repairs on which we were, which my client was successful, it is the reason Rexham stayed in the building, 17 months later, and held over. We were continually fighting about those repairs throughout this case. We lost time prior to that October date on depositions and discovery and multiple document requests related to repairs. So what the court found was it's a good compromise. It was a good place. And I would remind this court that the lower court's decision on attorney's fees is entitled to great discretion. And I think one of the reasons is because the district court can evaluate what went on. They know the many discovery disputes, the relentless litigation tactics pursued by Rexham. And I think the district court was in the best position to say, if I've got to award this number at some point, here's the best place. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dowell. Anything further, Mr. McLaughlin? You've got about 43 seconds.
Your Honor, very briefly, there is nothing in the record about the economics of the replacements of the roof. The record is absolutely blank. The roofs were replaced. There's nothing on the economics. Rexham testified, Clancy, that they started to get out of the building and started looking for new space in May of 06, not March or April of 07. The transfer was virtually immediate. The court, as to the tax advantages, if you look at Schedule B of the lease, you will see that Rexham had the right to buy the building back for one-tenth of the original price. The economic argument made by the appellant here does not stand up under the express terms of the lease. The evidence doesn't support it. It is a fiction. Rexham should have and could have bought the building for far less. Again, one-tenth, Schedule B. Here also, if you look at the Presbyterian decision, you'll see that a ceiling collapsed, and the court held that that was the result of ordinary wear and tear. The argument made that ordinary wear and tear stops is incorrect. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.